Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories. Hey everyone, Data Stories 51. I'm Moritz and there's Enrico.
Hey Moritz, how's it going?
Good, a bit of a cold, but that's usual, I guess.
Yeah, that's the right time of the year.
Sipping tea, ginger tea.
Shame on you, normally it's wine.
Yeah, I'm getting old. Yeah, no, I'm just gathering my powers here and drinking some ginger tea.
Yeah.
How are things for you? Still busy probably with the semester?
Yeah, busy with the semester, but it's getting better. I'm really excited about my class. I think we assigned a lot of interesting projects. Mm-hmm. So now I'm curious to see what they are able to do. So let's see. Last year it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And this year, hopefully, it's going to be even more fun. Let's see what happens.
So you're beyond the introductions and now you get into the...
Yeah, now I'm getting to the core part of it. And actually, I think next lecture is going to be on visual encoding, which is kind of like the soul, heart and soul of visualization. And I still... So this year, for the first time, I would like to create some smart exercises because I think... Especially the encoding part is something that where students need to play with things a lot before they understand exactly what it is and how powerful it is. So if you have any suggestions, I'm happy.
Yeah, I would totally do the 3775 exercise.
Absolutely.
I do it every time and it's always a huge success and very eye-opening and it's really good. So
I vaguely remember... I think Kim Rees has one where she gives buttons to the spare buttons to the class, and that's then they have to arrange things with buttons. That's a really good one as well.
And good idea to do something practical because you can talk about
You cannot really learn encoding by thinking about it. I guess I think you have to try and try again.
Cool. Two quick updates for me. I just came back from Future Everything. So as you can see, I'm traveling all the time now. It's this time of the year.
Nice.
Future Everything, good conference on digital culture. And they had a track on haunted machines, investigating the relation of magic and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a joke, but it's really good. Turns out it's a really interesting perspective to take. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to talk about what's going on in tech culture today in a bit of a metaphorical world, and that allows you to sort of think different thoughts, I think. And that was really fascinating. And they had a whole sub-conference on this wider theme, like 6-7 different talks. They will be online. I will link to them. I think they were quite enlightening and also fun.
Can you give us an example of what happens there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just transferring this whole world, let's say, you know, what happens in the startups and in Silicon Valley and at Apple, you know, and transfer that into the world of mages and wizards and witches and, you know, and suddenly a lot of things, you can talk about things in a different way. And I mean, technology is still a very opaque black box magic type thing to many people. You know, and the people who exercise it have great powers, right? And nobody really knows how this works, you know, except the people doing it. And there's also charlatans and mystics and, you know, people who just use the same symbols, but actually don't really know what's going on. And there's white hats and black hats. You know, if you think it through, it all makes sense suddenly. Yeah. So
you know, you just reminded me of a story many years back when I was still in Rome. The shop where I used to go to buy computers and devices, there was a lady who actually came and she was super scared about getting a virus from her computer.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. I found it really interesting.
And in a way, it's exactly what we want to avoid also, that people think it's magic. You know, we want to be very transparent and simple, but the way it plays out is much different. So it's a very interesting theme. And I think it becomes a whole... a whole longer discourse, I think, around it. So if you follow Haunted Machines on Twitter, or search for the word hauntology, which I find as well. That's a good starting point. And we will link from that to that from the show notes, of course.
Sure.
Second, we finally launched on the web our Broadway installation. So the project we did with
Manovich,
cool Dominikus Bauer, Daniel Godemeyer. We put that on the web so you can actually, you know, browse the same data as we have in the interactive installation at New York Public Library. And yeah, I think it turned out really well. Dominikus did a fantastic job of like making that work in normal browsers. It's quite amazing. And you should give it a shot. We'll link to it from the blog post.
So can we go visiting on at the public library?
Yeah, so that's the whole year. It's in the ground floor, no entrance fee. If you go to New York Public Library, you can play with the application and also see the rest of the exhibition, which is really great. It's 175 years of photography and really great pieces from the whole time span. Or you go to the URL provided in the blog post, and then you can play with the interactive application yourself and also see the documentation and some of the thinking behind it and where the data came from, things like this.
Great.
Yeah. And that leads me directly, segueing nicely to our guest today, because he's also really into cities, among many other things, but also cities. And that's Dietmar Offenhuber, and he's sitting right next to Enrico now, but I'm sitting in Germany, so it's totally a strange situation.
We have an interesting setting today.
Yeah, very confusing. But hi, Dietmar.
Yeah, great. Hi, Moritz.
Hi, Enrico. Dietmar.
Yeah,
great
it's
having
been a while
you here.
Since we met. So actually, just anecdotally, Dietmar was organizing, for instance, a workshop called The Scent of Information in Linz, 2007, maybe?
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago, yeah.
And this is where I first met Lev Manovich, so you see how everything's connected,
yeah.
And it's all a big conspiracy, actually.
Exactly. So all a conspiracy, yeah.
Yeah, that's it always comes back to the same people.
Yeah, thanks
so
for
Dietmar,
having me.
Can you tell us a bit about your background and what you're doing now?
Dietmar Offenhuber. I'm currently on faculty at Northeastern University in Boston, and I'm heading a new MFA program for information design and visualization, which is very exciting because we are, you know, exploring many different things, trying to figure out how to position this in a really interdisciplinary framework. But I also have a kind of a second life as a urban planner. And I've always been fascinated with, you know, reading the city in different way and understanding how, you know, space in a way, what is the role of space in society?
Yeah. And I mean, you have quite a diverse background. So when did you start working creatively with computers? That must have been
in the 90s. I started as an architecture student without really having the firm plan to ever become an architect. I just found it interesting and I started. This was actually in architecture, I have to say, the 90s were a very interesting time because everyone was playing around with all kinds of different technology. Nobody actually designed buildings. Everyone designed virtual kind of sculptures and responsive things, and we all thought that this is really important
systems.
And is very very cutting edge. And but then I got a little bit sidetracked, and I worked with Ars Electronica Future Lab, which is it's a little bit like a small Austrian media lab where we worked on all kinds of different projects and installations. And I spent there around 10 years before finally finishing my architecture degree. And then I, after a couple of other things, I joined the media lab in at MIT in the sociable media group with Judith Donat, who is an amazing academic, and she was pretty much ahead of her time in terms of social media. And but I always knew that I was more interested in urban systems. So then I followed with a PhD at the Urban Planning Institute at MIT with Sensible City Lab. And yeah, that is the story so far.
And then you went to Northeastern. Are you now fully employed at Northeastern?
Yeah.
Hop between.
I'm basically, so the MFA program basically takes all my time. So I'm fully immersed in that at the moment.
So yes, this is the School of Design, or what?
It's at the School of Design, but I have a dual appointment also in the Public Policy and Urban Affairs program. This is something that Northeastern likes to do, having, you know, mixing things up and having people associated with different departments.
Nice.
Yeah, that sounds really promising. And if you're looking for a good MFA, this might be one. Yeah, because also these young study programs, there's still a chance. So it might be a bit more unorganized, but there's also still a chance to own it and sort of make it the way you want it, right?
It is. I mean, it requires definitely a lot of, people have... We're looking for students who have a vision, who you know want to go into a certain direction, and it's quite interesting actually. I have people who are marine biologists or people who come from completely different fields, but then got interested in visualization, and this is actually. I mean, I think visualization in a way is, I always think of visualization as a kind of a boundary discipline that is most powerful at the boundary between different disciplines, where it's always about, you know, translating or facilitating, exchange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is so true. I'm always amazed, especially going through so many interviews in Data Stories, how many different backgrounds people have in this area. It's really, really amazing. I mean, you have a background in architecture, then you do stuff in design, then urban planning is very, very interesting. And I don't know, myself, I am a computer engineer, but devoted to visualization, and other people have completely different kinds of background. That's probably the beauty of it. I mean, probably that's
and
the reason why we
get
like
to work with all the experts at the other end.
Exactly, fields, right? Exactly. So, yeah.
Because usually you have a topic outside of visualization to work on.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And there are so many different kinds of people who do need visualization, right? Mm.
And also if you look back in history, I mean, a lot of the, you know, visualization, you know, the milestones came from different disciplines, not necessarily graphic design.
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of statisticians have done good things in visualization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cool. So shall we talk about a few of your projects before we come to your recent books and also the main topic of what we want to talk about? So one project I found really, really interesting is Wegzeit, which translates to way time. Could you say that?
Yeah. So it was. This was actually my architecture thesis in. I worked on it in 1999 and until 2000, and so I was interested in the notion of relative space. How, you know, Los Angeles as a city that is really, really regular for most of its part. You know, becomes distorted in the subjective experience of time, of attention, and all those different things. So this was actually before, there was really an audience for this type of visualization and processing, I think, was also more or less in the same time when Ben and Casey started developing processing. So there were not really any tools so I worked with mostly with technology that doesn't work anymore today. So the project is more or less lost. But
was it
was something called Virtools. It came out from they had a web three, they had very big plans for web 3D.
It was a bit like Unity. Like
yes,
the slot that Unity has today was captured by Virtools at the time.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, but a couple of years ago, it more or less disappeared from the stage.
Too bad. But you still have some 160 by 120 quick demos.
Yeah, exactly. The historical documents, yeah.
Yeah, but I thought the thinking behind it is still very current, that, you know, we have geographical space and then we have this sort of extra layers that distort this so-called real world, yeah, and are maybe actually more real than the actual physical world. Like,
yeah, I was
the time and the digital overlays and so on. I think that's it's still a theme we're all still working on, I guess, right?
Yeah, maybe you want to describe how these visualizations look like. I know that it's hard to describe things like that.
Yeah, well, I mean,
to give an impression of what the project is about.
So the issue is with time space. So I mean, I was really influenced by all these human geographers from the late 60s and early 70s. And, this kind of difficulty at representing, you know, once you replace absolute units of space with relative units, the whole geometry of space more or less falls apart. Because when you go from point A to point B, the distance from point B to point A, so the opposite direction, might be a completely different one. So the whole consistency of space falls apart. So I had to think of, you know, different geometrical interpretations to deal with these distinctions. For example, for this kind of distances, I use this metaphor that you basically climb a mountain. So when you're on the slower path and it goes down, one, if you're on the faster track, and so basically as you choose your route through the city, the whole city more or less becomes a kind of a three-dimensional shape that basically always tells you whether you're on the faster or on the lower track. But this was just one of seven different ones. One funny thing was I tried to reconstruct the city based on telephone conversations. So I called up different companies from the yellow pages and asked them to describe the way to their office. Then I used this as my virtual starting point and asked another company. And I think I had about, you know, 50 or, you know, more than 50 of these conversations. And then I basically tried to reconstruct the city just based from these descriptions. And it worked remarkably well. That was the interesting thing, because LA, and this is something special about LA that people, you know, are used to driving. And so they have a very, they're very good at giving directions. And it was amazing.
And then you have stripes. I saw that one where you have stripes that represent time.
Yeah, that was the other thing. I mean, this was more or less Google Street View, but only in 2000, where I basically mounted two cameras in the side windows of my car, and I systematically traveled different parts of LA and mapped the time distances at the same time, but also traffic light phases and those kind of things.
So this means that the stripes have the same length, but they also represent the same amount of time.
Yes, right? But they also they deformed based on so their shape changed. So that's the kind of distortion based thing. Yeah.
So you've done that in 2000.
Yeah, this was 2001 when I did the kind of distortion based representations.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great project. So I hope there's some documentation still left.
Yeah, maybe when I really have time, I can go back to
it. That's an interesting problem. I think we discussed that before, Moritz. I don't remember with whom, but how do we create archives? I think with Manuel Lima we discussed that, right?
Exactly.
How do you create
archives,
right?
It's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Maybe we should all like screen capture much more of our work.
Well, that at Ars Electronica, this was a big issue all the time, because, you know, new media art since, let's say, the mid-90s has taken many different forms and shapes. And yeah, this archival aspect is a really crucial one.
Yeah, I mean, the other option is always to do just more projects and even better ones.
Yeah, I think that's the better choice, because, you know, who cares about the old stuff?
So you don't have to care about the old stuff.
I don't know.
Stuff.
I tend to be a little sentimental about these things.
No, absolutely. I mean, and also, I love to show We Feel Fine, for instance, but this one's going away. You know, nobody uses Blogger anymore.
Yeah,
Java is hard to get to run. You know, at the moment, you can see it go away, basically. And yeah, in half a year, it's gone. And that's tough. Yeah. Yeah, so, but I think we need to solve that at another day. I won't solve that today.
Maybe we should invite Jonathan Harris sometime.
Maybe. So at least it would be audio documented.
Give him some tasks to update and document it. Yeah.
And then you did a lot of great like work, actually more on visualization, like a lot of network visualizations. So the Common Flow project. And I think you developed a whole network visualization framework for a couple of network related projects, right?
Yeah, this was at during my time at the Media Lab. I was also back at Ars Electronica. I was interested in networks, and this was around 2004 when social networking started to become an issue, an interesting issue. And at that time, I worked with a basically self-described diagram researcher, Gerhard Diermoser. You should check out his work. He's doing amazing stuff.
Yeah. And he's the master of networks.
It was from him that I heard the term diagrammatics for the first time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he has this huge collection of all kinds of diagrams and networks. And so he always tried, and I think he's still working on that, coming up with all kinds of different taxonomies of representations that, you know, like performative taxonomies or, all kinds of different ways of categorizing and understanding diagrams. And so he had all these images, and this was around 2005 maybe. So we tried to, I developed a Java program for him to organize those things in 3D. This became a network tool, SEMA space, that a couple of people in the humanities mostly used. But I'm, at this point, I'm not developing it, actively anymore. But back then, the main interest was just to get as much performance, out of the computers that were available at that mm-hmm. time as possible.
Yeah, and I remember it worked really well, like was very fluent. It had like auto layout, so the layout was constantly updating when you were doing selection. So technically that was quite a feat. But these things are tough to like, it's easy to get a good start, but then to maintain a network visualization library, really, it's tough. I mean, then you really need to get into computer science and have a bigger team probably. And
But luckily it's not necessary anymore because there are so many great tools at the moment that, Giphy. Why?
Yeah. Why bother? No, but at the time it was very helpful to have it and also useful, but you're right. I mean, at some point then it's time to move on. Yeah. And then, well, we briefly had an encounter together in the Mapping the Archive project.
Exactly.
That was fun, like looking at the Ars Electronica archive, all the submissions to Ars Electronica, working with the metadata there. And then you went to MIT pretty much right after. And I think the first project you were involved in was already a huge success, the Trash Track project, right?
So Trash Track was a very interesting project. This was, I didn't come up with the idea, so the project already started before I came to Sensible City Lab, but I then basically took the lead and over the largest part of the deployment. So basically what we did is we attached 2,500 GPS trackers to garbage in order to find out where the garbage goes.
Yeah,
and
which is brilliant.
It's brilliant.
It was a great project, and it was actually, many difficulties that you wouldn't expect. How do you do that? How do you attach a GPS tracker to, old banana peel or something like that?
How do you do that?
The details. They are very messy details, I have to say.
You need gloves, first of all.
There was actually, we used the epoxy foam that is normally used for insulating boat hulls and filling surfboards. So this was a foam that really encapsulated the GPS tracker and attached it to the object so that you couldn't rip it off anymore. And all of that was necessary because we were concerned that the trackers would get separated and from the object. But we also wanted to hide it so you don't see. But you also had to make sure that, as you can imagine, the the waste stream is not really a hospitable place for sensitive electronic devices. So it had to be there had to be a physical protection and waterproofing. So and all of that we managed to accomplish with this foam. But at the same time, it had to be fast, so because it was very work intense to prepare those items. Mm-hmm. We developed a whole process to do that.
And there are no precedents for that, so there's no blogs on how to.
Yeah, to I mean there have been a few people who worked with different kinds of tracking mechanisms for single mm-hmm. objects. As a, I think even Greenpeace did a. They tracked one monitor to Nigeria, but not, so they had to basically always follow the device because there was no, no back channel. I mean, it's trivial to get the GPS location from the object, but how do you get the data back? That's the big question.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So how did you do it?
And how did you?
So in our case, we used the cell phone network, which of course also doesn't exist on the ocean. And unfortunately, is very spotty in many places where landfills and those kind of trash facilities are. But yeah, I mean, it was actually much better than we expected in the beginning.
So the devices were constantly like pinging a server with their current location and the server would collect the data?
Well, that was the other problem, that we really wanted to have those devices be to survive for 6 months. But, you know, if you think about, you know, those trackers, they look like very small cell phones, but, you know, usually cell phones don't last that long. So with the engineers, we had to figure out a way how they would save as much energy as possible. And mm-hmm. basically they would only turn themselves on every 6 hours or so, send one ping. And if they cannot reach a signal, then they basically give up. Exactly.
Yeah.
So how many of them arrived at their destination?
Yeah, we were getting good at it because in the end we got 80% success rate. Beginning was lower, but yeah.
Damn. Cool. And how big was one of the sensors?
It was maybe like a matchbox, something like that.
Okay.
So it's not like those James Bond type of trackers that are, you know, tiny that
but
you don't
still
see.
Still small enough to be hidden.
Yes.
Is this something that would be? I mean, this is now how many years ago? 6 or 7?
Yeah, we started in 2009, but the project took quite a while because we had to wait until, you know, all the items have settled that we tracked, and then the data analysis part was quite work intense, and so yeah, we did a couple of follow-ups with, you know, informal waste systems and you know, international movement of waste and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's still in a way a challenge to look at infrastructures that way. And I guess there are many opportunities to.
Yeah, I love this general idea that we take something, that we take for granted as, trash somehow works, but it's not my problem. But it's also very intransparent and, you know, nobody knows how it works.
Yeah.
Probably
it's
not even the people running it.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And just, you know, throw out a couple of probes, gather data and see what you can learn about that. I think that's so valuable, really.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, like, if somebody wanted to do something like this today, would you use the same technology or what would your tech approach be if you were to start it today?
Well, I mean, I guess... you would still pretty much have to rely on active location sensors, so on sensors that have a battery and have a radio that send back the data. But in some countries and in some cities, they are working with passive sensors, with RFID. And there's this, you know, this smart city idea that, you know, all your waste bins and everything is identified by smart tags. And then all the facilities and all the trash trucks have reading devices that would identify all those different tags. And then you get this kind of, you know, total legibility of your infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. And RFID is much smaller, right?
Yeah, and much cheaper. So, much cheaper. You know, if you really want to build a whole citywide system like that, GPS doesn't make sense. But GPS makes sense if you don't have any leads where those things might go. And also if you want to look at those things in a kind of accountability or forensic perspective, for example, if you want to find out whether, you know, someone is smuggling e-waste into, you know, some out of the country of things like that.
Cool. I mean, I think it's a very fascinating project, and I wish there was more in this direction. There's also the in Barcelona the citizen sensor toolkit project, which I'm looking into.
Absolutely.
Because they also have a bee fork, so it's something for beehives, and so that's kind of cool. And they have like a lot of tools around like DIY tracking, and so if somebody's interested, they are a good starting point, I think, as well. And I'm super curious what comes out of this whole like scene of DIY tracking. I think
I think it's totally cool.
So that's a good time to talk about our sponsor, Qlik. Imagine an analytics tool so intuitive that anyone in your company could easily create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards to find meaningful insights. That's QlikSense. QlikSense was launched in July 2014 and pairs Qlik's market-proven data indexing engine with the ability to drag and drop visualizations into your dashboard. Above all, QlikSense is intuitive. QlikSense lets you rapidly create visualizations, explore data deeply, reveal connections instantly, and see opportunities from every angle. QlikSense's data storytelling functionality is noteworthy as well, making it easy to share analysis with colleagues and collaborate more effectively. And QlikSense isn't just limited to the desktop. Access your analytics on the go, on a tablet or a smartphone. You can find your insights in real time. And if you want to get started quickly with QlikSense, you can also use the SenseIt extension for Google Chrome, which allows you to drag and drop data and visualize it directly in QlikSense. We will link it from the show notes. So try it out today. You can download QlikSense at qlik.de/datastories. And don't forget the data stories. And now back to the show. And I mean, then we are right in the main topic of smart cities, right? So this, exactly as you say, is about infrastructure and how we can make this sort of these super complex networks of activity more transparent. And you've been like working a lot on this topic of smart cities, especially at Sensible City Lab, I guess. So I thought maybe you can describe a bit to us, maybe to our listeners as well, what the general idea of smart cities is, and maybe start with the positive, like the most utopian vision. That's often the one we get presented as well. And then maybe we can also talk a bit about the flip side and what are the challenges for the smart city theory at the moment. And maybe not everything is that cool as it sounds in a 2-minute demo video or so. So how did it all start? Or what's the current state of smart cities? Can you give us a brief overview for the for somebody who has no idea, like me, for instance?
No, I think what you just mentioned, the Barcelona Smart Citizen Project, is a really good example for civic technologies, where this is this idea that, you know, you develop infrastructures from the bottom up to make sense of your environment, and that you have a better understanding of you know, things that matter to you, like, you know, safety or air quality and all those kinds of things. But this is maybe one of the more recent phenomena in that space. The idea of the smart city, or let's say the intelligent city, is a very old idea. I found it fascinating that even at the end, let's say, of the 19th century, when wireless communication and telephone came up, people started thinking about how those things start or would change our cities. And it actually did from very early moment on. If you think about, you know, we are here in Manhattan, we are here in Brooklyn, or if you think about New York and these early skyscrapers, you need a telephone, you know. I mean, how do you communicate in such a space? So the communication technology, in a way, made it possible to have a physical shape for buildings and then also for cities that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And also then in the 30s, I think Frank Lloyd Wright in his Broadacre City, he said that, well, you know, because we have cars, we have telephones, and we have automation, cities will disappear. So that, you know, we don't need this concentration anymore because we can easily beat the physical distance with the car, the kind of communication distance with the telephone, and we can basically scale this up so like everyone has access to it. And
which is kind of happening
really
today.
Work out, yeah.
It is. Well, it's interesting because there are always many different. So the problem with this, that this would be called usually as a techno-determinism, where you say, okay, this is my technology and it will have this deterministic historical outcome. And in some sense, it happens, but There's also another side to it, and you have lots of paradoxical effects usually happening. Yeah. So, for example, we know that cities didn't really disappear. I mean, more than half of
the
population.
Get bigger.
Exactly.
It's a clear trend. Yeah.
And well, even in
maybe
the 60s,
maybe it just takes longer.
Maybe it takes longer. I mean, who knows? You know.
Maybe
I mean,
it's just that it takes longer.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, who knows? Yeah.
I think it's always a balance of forces, and this might be a force repelling people or like making it possible to go somewhere else. But then there's attracting forces that might be stronger and things like
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Yeah, and just the you know you have this paradoxical effect that suddenly the place becomes really valuable, becomes a kind of prestigious element. I mean, you could basically run a company from the middle of the some ex-urban business park, but you don't want to have your headquarters there necessarily, unless you're in a particular. And so you have all those kind of social political forces that basically mess with the technology, and then basically you get lots of interesting effects. I mean, for me, in my own, when I talked about how did I arrive at this point when I started working with Future Lab and speculating about future technologies, which was in the 90s, the main thing, but. After some time, I got more interested in how people actually use technology at the moment, because all those things became, in a way, mainstream. And then you get all these interesting social phenomena that all those kind of subcultures and whatsoever. And suddenly the future is not the main interesting thing anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I mean, currently, who... Like, are there many smart cities already? Or are many cities like becoming smarter and smarter? And who does this? Is it like, do the administrations do interesting things with data, or is it citizens? Is it corporations? Mm. What's your current feeling of the landscape there?
I think all of them have a stake in that game, but they all are. Basically have a different idea of what a smart city is. I mean, it's really interesting because I was just last year, I was invited to a conference in Germany about smart cities. And during the panel, I realized that they have a completely different understanding and definition of what a smart city is than what I thought. And
can you give us an example? I'm just curious.
Well, I always try to keep concepts very narrow and not basically expand them too much. So, and the way how I remember smart city, Bill Mitchell at the Media Lab, he had this group Smart Cities, and this was, around 2000, he started this group. And a couple of years later, IBM more or less adopted this term for smarter planet and smarter cities. And if you remember IBM as a kind of IT technology, since the 1970s and 60s, they've been providing IT infrastructure. And so their vision for a smart city was a very infrastructural one. It was all about attaching sensors to existing urban infrastructure and then optimizing and making everything more efficient.
And like a big machine, right?
Yeah, right. There's the CD as a machine, and then there's this fascinating control center in Rio de Janeiro that I think many of you have seen. And, you have these huge screens where you have data feeds that come in from all different parts of the city, all different infrastructures of the city. And so this is a little bit this kind of, one could say, cybernetic idea of the smart city, where you look at the city as this kind of feedback system, where you have a kind of a machine intelligence that tries to optimize that. And of course, this is something that raises a lot of criticisms as well. First of all, because some of these things have already been tried in the 60s and 70s, and some of them failed in very spectacular ways. So, for example, in New York, there was a big project where in the 1970s they tried to optimize the fire response system through a cybernetic a cybernetic algorithm. The RAND Corporation worked on that, and there were. As a result, there were many areas that were underserved by those fire trucks, and then there were a lot of fires that basically had a really huge catastrophic impact on the inner cities.
They might have tried it out on something less.
Yes, exactly. But the thing is, that's a story that has been told many times. Even here, that there are many layers to it, because the reason why this has failed is because the planners did not think about the political and social issues. And then, of course, a certain politician has an influence why a specific fire station has to be in a specific place, and not every voice has the same weight. So that's the interesting thing in about cities, that you cannot escape, and those are the main things, those social and political issues. But I actually read this RAND report from the 70s on the fire stations, and actually the algorithm is interesting, and as far as I know, it's still used today in fire response. So there are many interesting aspects to it, but I think there's quite a consensus that this cybernetic idea of the smart city that basically only focuses on the infrastructure is not really something that we want.
So what is your definition of smart city? What do you
Yeah, I mean, smart city as a definition, I mean, smart city is in a way a branded term. It's like big data, smart city, and social software, Web 2.0.
Oh, I smell a future proposal there.
No, but I'm just curious to pick your brain. What you think is a smart city? What you think?
Or what would be the positive vision? Like, why are you working
on that? Yeah, I mean, We've already touched upon this more community integrated aspect of civic technologies, where you look at urban governance not so much as an optimization problem, but more as a communication problem between government and its citizens. So it becomes a kind of co-production where citizens play a role in decisions. And of course, participation is also a term that has been misused many times. But in the end, there are many different layers to that as well. So in Boston, there is, for example, in City Hall, they have an office for new urban mechanics, how they call themselves. And and they're all about making city services accessible through technology. And they are really interested in this idea of engaging the citizen in so that they would see infrastructure or the city as a public good, and they're contributing to that. But of course, there's also the opposite, where it's not about this friendly idea of engagement, but where it's really about conflict and accountability. And sometimes, if the city is not responsible or is not responsive, the citizens might just start building their own tools to in a more activist mode and start to call attention to an issue that they discover. And there are also many historical examples, especially also in the US with, issues of pollution and toxic waste that are unfortunately still hidden in and buried in many cities here.
We also had Mike Migurski on one of the shows who built the Oakland crime spotting thing, which also basically took an existing data feed but then made it more visible.
Yeah.
And that fed back into the political discussion. And I think these things are all quite interesting. Yeah.
So what are the most interesting or most common data feeds coming from a city typically? Mm. And what can you do with them?
So in terms of open data, so I mean the basic idea of open data is that you not only give access to data that is generated by the city, but you also give access in a way that you can have it machine readable, that you basically have real-time feeds that can automatically be processed in, you know, all kinds of apps that you wanna that can be developed. And there are a lot of people are working with this kind of 311 data sets, which are kind of community incident reports when people complain about things, but which are not necessarily, emergencies, but it's basically, just suggestions for improvements. And, they're definitely, these reports are definitely interesting data sets because they allow you really to read the city in a very, a granular way. And transit is a big issue. I mean, when urban transit systems finally got around to deliver real-time data streams, everyone started developing transit apps to, you know, plan your route through the city. And in a way you could also say
taxi rides are, for New York, you have a full data set of taxi rides.
That's an amazing data set.
And 170 million trips.
exactly. And when you go back in history in the 90s, I mean, even something like GPS, GPS used to be military technology, but if you think about how many current applications depend on GPS as a kind of a open real-time data set that everyone has more or less access to, it's not strictly speaking a data set, but I think that the idea is the same.
So is there anyone doing something interesting with cameras? Because there are so many cameras spread around every city.
Yeah, I mean, this is a definitely interesting thing. I mean, you're definitely always run into the discussion of privacy when you talk about data collection in public space, and it's a very tricky thing because legally everyone more or less can take a picture in public space and because it's public but then if you basically scrape all this information from public space and basically use it in all kinds of aggregated in all kinds of different ways, then you definitely have
you can connect the dots. Basically.
Exactly. You can connect the dots and you have a privacy problem. And you also have a governance issue. So I think Chicago has this program where they installed these street lights that are smart street lights. And so they, count the pedestrians. They do have all kinds of environmental sensors. They have sound sensors, everything. But they look like a, very old-fashioned lamp, like from the, Paris 1920 or something like that.
Yeah.
And
romantic.
So it's very romantic, sentimental object, but that basically records all that stuff. So
it's almost like an art project.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what I'm interested in is this question of infrastructure legibility. I mean, it should be possible to make sense or to understand when something is recording something and also having access to the data that those things collect. But then you also have a governance issue because, what happens, who decides how long this data gets stored, and so on. So all those kind of, for me at the moment, those kind of governance issues, especially when you have all this algorithmic decision making that is taking over many, many different traditional aspects of public life, where, you know, how accountable are these algorithms? I mean, who, if let's say a self-driving car has an accident, who is responsible, and those kind of questions.
Yeah, that scales to any size, problem, of course. I think the other huge problem is sort of one of, if you naively follow just your sensor data, you will automatically focus on the areas where a lot is being measured.
Yeah.
So sort of this self fulfilling prophecy, or we had, I think, with Kate Crawford, this discussion that they had the sort of program in Boston where you could report bad streets with your smartphone, but then where people report bad streets is where people have smartphones to report them.
Exactly.
So you suddenly just optimize the part of the city where you get the most reports, because people have the technology and time to, you know, and the awareness of that. So how do you deal with this, like all these blind spots that appear and all these misreadings?
I think the question whether this kind of crowdsourced or volunteered information is biased or not doesn't make sense, because it's biased by definition.
That's the whole point.
I mean, it's you know, there's self-selection going on.
Oh, absolutely.
And
And but maybe it's more a matter of awareness, right? Knowing that when you are using this data, there is a
absolutely
distortion.
And yeah, that, I mean, that's one of the big challenges, because all those kind of big data sets are, you know, they're big, but they're also unstructured, and they have all kinds of distortions. And, and anyway, if you think about what the term data actually means, I mean, the way how I would define it, I mean, data points are observations, but observations that are made in a systematic way and that are encoded into symbols. So you have all these different steps, you know, the observation, the encoding, and the categorization. You have to think about the symbolic language that is fitting. All those are human decisions that someone has to make at some point. So the question whether data is a raw material or whether it's something that is socially constructed also doesn't make sense, because it's clear that it's heavily constructed. Mm-hmm. And if you work with, let's say, data sets from astronomy where you're hunting for planets, you know, this is not really a problem, because, you know, what can go wrong? But if you're dealing with urban data sets, you're constantly confronted with this question of, you know, all those kind of social and political issues that are implicated in not only the data collection, but also in the way how data is stored, and, you know, at any point. And I think, so I've been thinking a lot about bias, because there's a lot of discussion about, you know, about the definition or the nature or the quality of data, but the bias is a concept that we all take for granted. You know, we just say data is biased, but, you know, what do we actually mean when we talk about bias? And my answer to that is that when we deal with crowdsourced information, very often the term bias does not really capture everything that is going on, because bias actually means that there is a truth, and the bias is a deviation of the truth. But in many different aspects of these data sets, there is no truth, you know, there is no kind of canonical form. It is basically just, you know, let's say you report a broken street to the city. You can think about bias in terms of, you know, to what extent a certain demographic is represented in the reports. And then you can say, okay, there are people who don't have smartphones and you have less reports from them. But then if you look at the content, you know, there's no, you know, there's no true form how such a report is supposed to take shape. And there are many different mechanisms for reporting. So I'm inclined to also think more about not just as bias, but also on the assumptions that go into the design of the technology. And the design basically includes not only, let's say, the interface that is used for capturing, but also the language and the categories and basically the social protocols and basically it's a very broad thing.
So yeah. I'm curious, in your experience, to what extent do you think that people who make decisions based on this data coming from smart cities are aware of these problems? Because if I understand correctly what you're saying, you're kind of like saying the solution is not in creating better data or unbiased data, because this might actually be even impossible, but more making these assumptions explicit.
Yeah, right? I mean,
so people who make decisions on top of this data, do you think they are aware of these distortions or biases or whatever you want to call it?
I mean, there's a cynical answer to this could be that from an economic standpoint, it doesn't really matter. Because let's say if you use predictive analytics systems to make decisions and you are wrong 4 times out of 5, it might not matter if the one time you're right really, you know.
That's
a real problem. That's why, you know, all those kind of smart city companies are interested in correlation and not in causality, because the causality doesn't really, you know, is not really that actionable. They're not really concerned that they're always right, but they're concerned that in the cases when they are right, they have enough profit or have enough advantage to, make it worthwhile to do the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this idea of the false positive, you know, is the false positive a good or a bad thing? You know, either from an epistemological standpoint, it's a bad thing, but maybe from an economic standpoint, maybe it's not. I don't know.
So can you give us an example Moritz. Can you give us an example of what these companies are trying to predict?
I'm not an expert in the kind of social media marketing. I mean, there are whole industries that are dedicated to that, so I'm not going to talk about that. But let's say with this predictive analytics in policing, that's actually a big deal, because police forces are also there are budget cuts and they cannot be everywhere. So they are using all kinds of spatial statistics methods to figure out where most likely a crime would occur. And again, I mean, you know, it's not important for them that every single time they go to a specific place that there is actually a crime that they prevent, but they're just interested in to prevent, you know, in one of the, I don't know, one of 100 times when, you know, actually something happens that they are there. But this, of course, creates also the whole, you know, social externalities. And in New York, it's a huge issue with the, with, you know, all those kind of police tactics of stop and frisk. So I think those are the governance and social issues that are at stake.
Yeah, here. And that comes back to this question of what it means to optimize.
Yeah, exactly.
often you optimize for a certain countable metric. And we had that in the US quite a bit, that certain police departments had to deliver so and so many stops in a given time frame. But I don't think that necessarily optimized the quality of life for the citizens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so,
I mean,
so they optimized their simple countable metric, but at the same time de-optimized actual quality of life.
And absolutely.
Then it becomes problematic, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think the whole idea of what does it mean to optimize something? This is also something that
especially
has changed
as
a city. Yeah, I mean, this cybernetic idea of finding the most efficient way to run a city is not really.
I don't want my city to be.
Yeah,
too
exactly,
efficient.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
I like this mess.
Exactly. You need.
Otherwise, I wouldn't live in New York.
Exactly. 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 Yeah, and the cities are getting more chaotic. I mean, everything gets more informal in a certain way. There is a, I think people are also not so concerned about this idea of efficiency anymore, because, you know, or if you want to have a resilient city, you actually want a city that is not efficient. Because an efficient city breaks down and then it's gone, you know.
Even though I think that we don't even realize, I mean, normal citizens don't realize, and I don't realize how much is going on in a city every single day, right? There are lots of people whose job is running this city, right? Every single day. So that's another interesting aspect.
I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a great opportunity for data analysis and visualization, because I think I also did a few city visualization projects, and it's always so fascinating because it feels like you're looking at an organism, right? So it's like there is this higher order thing going on, you know, that we can suddenly observe. And I think that's just so, it's cool to work on that.
No, absolutely. And just also...
What do you think, looking 10 years ahead, what will be the biggest impact this whole city sensing and making sense of cities and sorting out cities and all these things? What's the biggest impact this will have? Like, how will it change how we live? What's your wild guess? Or what would you put your money on today?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you look at the global scale of how, you know, cities change, we see that the biggest cities are no longer in the US and in Europe. I think if we, you know, there are these kind of UN predictions of 2030, and from the 25 biggest cities in this prediction, I think only two or three are in Europe and the US, and all the other ones are in Southeast Asia and in many places that we used to call developing countries, but that description doesn't make sense anymore because they're actually very dynamic places. But if we look at one aspect that I think is very interesting and will be very important in the future, it's the question of informality. If you think of many cities in the global south, you have a huge informal economy that basically runs, you know, waste collection and street vendors and all kinds of things. And, you know, in the 1970s, we thought that those, you know, are just a kind of temporary phenomenon. They will go away. And after everything is modernized, you know, there will be no informality anymore. But now we know that this is not going to happen. It's exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, it's not the biggest point, but I think technology also has a role in that. Because in a way, technology makes the formal more informal because you can communicate more easily. But on the other hand, it also makes the informal more formal because suddenly even a, you know, casual telephone conversation leaves all kinds of traces that in a way become, you know, a formal document. And this dynamic between formality and informality, maybe this is a little bit too philosophical, but I think this will have many implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and higher opportunities for self-organization and flexibility. I mean, Uber, it's a horrible company, but the general trend is interesting that, you know, suddenly everybody can be a taxi driver, basically, because they have a smartphone. And if you think that through, Airbnb and so on, suddenly you have these self-run places maybe at some point.
Yeah, and Uber is an interesting example because, I mean, I also, I mean, I share your concerns about it, but it's interesting the way how it makes the whole process legible again. So in terms of visualization, you call a cab, you see where the cab is, you can follow it, you get
that's
in.
All brilliant. Absolutely.
Yeah, and then you after, you know, even after you arrived at your destination, you see exactly where you went and have this connection with the driver. You can rate them, and so, you know, you have a completely mediated experience that doesn't just start when you enter the car and ends when you leave it, but it basically is a bigger part of a bigger thing, and that is, you know, scary in some ways because, you know, there was this anecdote. What was this? The Rides of Glory. Do you remember this story?
No idea.
where Uber started to publicize those cases where someone would take an Uber to a place that is not their own home. on Saturday night and
late at night
and come back home in the morning, implying, of course, there was something going on. And, you know, I guess many people were not amused about that. So
yeah, and then you're suddenly in all this mess of privacy, and yeah. Then it suddenly goes all wrong, right? So that's so interesting. Yeah, but I think that's interesting that you say it's actually a chance to move out of Kafkaesque, like, authorities running the place, yeah, to much more self-organized.
I mean, people are super quick. Exactly. I mean, people are super quick at developing all kinds of tactics against this. So we are still trying to wrap our head around what is predictive analytics and what are the implications. Mm-hmm. But people already know exactly how to game it and how to take advantage of it.
Yeah. Draw shapes in the city exactly. With GPS tracks when running and so on. Yeah. So if you're looking for the hackable city, is that right?
Exactly. Well, that's one vision, of course, yeah.
Cool. It's fantastic. Enrico, do you have more questions? I think we're coming to an end soon.
We are coming to an end soon.
We could, as usual, go on for five more hours.
Yeah. No, I'm just curious. So you've been mentioning the idea that most of the big cities are in South Asia, and considering other regions of the world, I'm wondering if the whole idea of smart cities is happening in other regions, like, for instance, in Africa,
mm-hmm.
where I think Africa had a very interesting development in terms of technology, where, for instance, mobile technology mm-hmm. was adopted much, much quicker than computers, right?
So absolutely.
So I'm wondering how this impacts the whole concept of smart cities.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is exactly, and I also think that something like Bitcoin, you know, I mean, also has a kind of strange reputation, but I think it's actually a very... It's a technology that will have a big impact on and especially on the developing world where Bitcoin suddenly becomes a way to send back money across the globe very easily without fees and without so I would also count those places. And, you know, I've been working in Brazil with this kind of waste picker cooperatives who are actually pretty sophisticated in the way how they operate their businesses. And so they create this, you know, impeccable material of, you know, recyclable material that is very valuable. And they all have cell phones. Of course, you know, some of them are cannot read or write, but they know how to operate a smartphone. Yeah. And it's not for them, this is not a contradiction. So... because it's also, you know, if you look at this question of the digital divide, I mean, there's certainly a digital divide in terms of education. But if you look at the actual price of technology and what you can get out of it, I would say that, you know, living and apartment and rents and those kind of things are much more expensive than a mobile phone. And so the mobile phone becomes a very important economic facilitator for many of these cities and the kind of populations that work in the informal sector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So do you know of any existing projects in these areas?
Yeah, so colleagues came back from Jakarta in Indonesia, and it's apparently one of the places where most cell phones are and smartphones, the highest smartphone density. And, you know, everyone has more or less their own business in, using the phone to do certain, things, whether it's kind of, you know, organizing parking spaces or things like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole space of disaster response where digital tools for coordination colleagues are working on a crowdsourced flooding response system in Jakarta. Crowdsourcing is difficult, of course, because you need a crowd, but that you don't always have. There's also something that is taken for granted.
Good stuff. Very interesting.
Yeah. All right.
Good having you on. Super fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Data Stories is brought to you by Click, who allows you to explore the relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Click Sense, which you can download for free at click.de/datastories. That's Q-L-I-K.de/datastories.